Still, we are in the evolution of the spiritual man, chapter 24 in the Life Divine. Roughly midway through the chapter, weeks more to go before we end our reading of it in January 2018. Sri Aurobindo has been discussing how the progressing growth of the spiritual consciousness in the human takes us into four different provinces. Province of occultism, where we begin to experience the inner forces behind the exteriors of nature. The development of our commerce with those inner powers into religion. Our progression from religion into an understanding rationally of what these great deep perceptions of the breadth and core of the cosmos mean in spiritual philosophy. And finally, of course, the thing that really is the determining factor is the spiritual experience and the spiritual realization. Now, he's been discussing where we are in the field of religion so far, so that's where we're going to pick up his argument here. We have to integrate the whole being into the experience of the spiritual. We must eliminate from religious doctrine the error that accompanies it, but not throw out the whole of what gives religion its force and its truth. We don't want to cancel all that is good in it simply because we find much that is imperfect. So we begin now. Evolutionary nature. In her first awakening of man to a rudimentary spiritual consciousness, must begin with a vague sense of the infinite and the invisible surrounding the physical being, a sense of the limitation and impotence of human mind and will, and of something greater than himself concealed in the world, of potencies, beneficent or maleficent, which determine the results of his action, a power that is behind the physical world he lives in and has perhaps created it and him, or powers that inform and rule her movements, while they themselves, perhaps, are ruled by the greater unknown that is beyond them. He had to determine what they are and find means of communication so that he might propitiate them or call them to his aid. He sought also for means by which he could find out and control the springs of the hidden movements of nature. This he could not do at once by his reason, because his reason could at first deal only with physical facts. But this was the domain of the invisible, and needed a supraphysical vision and knowledge. He had to do it by an extension of the faculty of intuition and instinct, which was already there in the animal. This faculty, prolonged in the thinking being and mentalized, must have been more sensitive and active in early man, though still mostly on a lower scale, for he had to rely on it largely for all his first necessary discoveries. He had to rely also on the aid of subliminal experience, for the subliminal, too, must have been more active, more ready to upsurge in him, more capable of formulating its phenomena on the surface, before he learned to depend completely on his intellect and senses. The intuitions that he thus received by contact with nature, his mind systematized and so created the early forms of religion. So, the human in its first commerce with the internal powers that govern the cosmos. Tentatively perceive, try to enter into contact, into relationship with, and have not to use the externalized physical mind, which is where reason then lives in the early ages of our societies, but instead utilize intuition and fashion a contact with them through that. So these intuitions, systematized, become religion and are the first forms of this inner explanation that he offers to the cosmos. How is it that it is thus? This active and ready power of intuition also gave him the sense of supraphysical forces behind the physical, and his instinct and a certain subliminal or supernormal experience of supraphysical beings with whom he could somehow communicate turned him towards the discovery of effective and canalizing means for a dynamic utilization of this knowledge. So were created magic and the other early forms of occultism. Because when you begin to learn the inner workings, then you develop contacts, relationships, and you are influenced by, you can become agents for their action, or you might be able to direct them. You might be able to enter into relationship with them in a way that conduces them to your will. At some time, Sri Aurobindo writes, it must have dawned on him that he had something in him which was not physical, a soul that survived the body. Certain supernormal experiences which became active because of the pressure to know the invisible must have helped to formulate his first crude ideas of this entity within him. It would only be later that he began to realize that what he perceived in the action of the universe was also there in some form within him, and that in him also were elements that responded to invisible powers and forces for good or for evil. So would begin his religio-ethical formations and his possibilities of spiritual experience. So you discover these larger powers inside the cosmos around. You begin to have some sort of concert with them. But you have a perception, too, developing that what is there is also here. There is a correspondence between the larger world and the inner. If there are inner powers of the cosmos, there are inner powers of the human as well. And if you learn how to accord yourself with the laws by which these powers in the greater universe and in your personal universe work, then your life can be in accord with the cosmic life. And thus, you have the formation of patterns of behavior which have been authenticated by your perception of the divine. An amalgam of primitive intuitions, occult ritual, religio-social ethics, mystical knowledge or experiences symbolized in myth, but with their sense preserved by a secret initiation and discipline, is the early, at first very superficial and external stage of human religion. In the beginning, these elements were no doubt crude and poor and defective, but they acquired depth and range and increased in some cultures to a great amplitude and significance. So here he talks about these first intuitions were at the core of the secret disciplines that gave form to religions. But as the mental and life development increased, for that is nature's first preoccupation in man, and she does not hesitate to push it forward at the cost of other elements that will need to be taken up fully hereafter. There is a tendency towards intellectualization, and the first necessary intuitive, instinctive, and subliminal formations are overlaid with the structures erected by a growing force of reason and mental intelligence. So here we see then the core of our first experiences become mentalized, and we start writing philosophy about our experiences. As man discovers the secrets and processes of physical nature, he moves more and more away from his early recourse to occultism and magic. The presence and felt influence of gods and invisible powers recedes as more and more is explained by natural workings, the mechanical procedure of nature. But he still feels the need of a spiritual element and spiritual factors in his life, and therefore keeps for a time the two activities running together. But the occult elements of religion, though still held as beliefs or preserved, but also buried in rites and myths, lose their significance and diminish, and the intellectual element increases. Finally, where and when the intellectualizing tendency becomes too strong, there is a movement to cut out everything but creed, institution, formal practice, and ethics. Even the element of spiritual experience dwindles, and it is considered sufficient to rely only on faith, emotional fervor, and moral conduct. The first amalgam of religion, occultism, and mystic experience is disrupted, and there is a tendency, not by any means universal or complete, but still pronounced or visible, for each of these powers to follow its own way to its own goal in its own separate and free character. A complete denial of religion, occultism, and all that is superphysical is the last outcome of this stage, a hard, dry paroxysm of the superficial intellect, hacking away the sheltering structures that are refuges for the deeper parts of our nature. So we see the deadly effect that the philosophizing mind has on the impact of our budding or our first spiritual experiences and understanding of the inner forces of the world, because it doesn't accept that. It accepts only the light of reason, and reason in a narrow province. But still, evolutionary nature keeps alive her ulterior intentions in the minds of a few, and uses man's greater mental evolution to raise them to a higher plane and deeper issues. In the present time itself, after an age of triumphant intellectuality and materialism, we can see evidences of this natural process, a return towards inner self-discovery, an inner seeking and thinking, a new attempt at mystic experience, a groping after the inner self, a reawakening to some sense of the truth and power of the spirit begins to manifest itself. Man's search after his self and soul and a deeper truth of things tends to revive and resume its lost force and to give a fresh life to the old creeds, erect new faiths, or develop independently of sectarian religions. It's worth pausing there to note that when he's writing these sentences, it's in the late 1930s, early 1940s, and we've seen the rise of theosophy in the 19th century in the West, which begins to put a more into a neutral gear the claim of philosophy and science to have the sole claim on truth, I guess. That religion, and then later psychology with Freud and Jung and Assagioli and others, could say, here, we have a body of verifiable truth which is more vibrant, more seminal than what you're telling us in your superficial sketches of nature, which, by the way, seem to change with every passing theory. Your measurements of the universe are as provisional as you think our inner explorations are of the cosmos. So some of this was going on in this debate back and forth in Sri Aurobindo's position. It could be a little different than what we would take now, writing in 2017, but much of what he says in 1940 is still applicable now. He continues here, the intellect itself, having reached near to the natural limits of the capacity of physical discovery, having touched its bedrock and found that it explains nothing more than the outer process of nature, has begun, still tentatively and hesitatingly, to direct an eye of research on the deeper secrets of the mind and the life force and on the domain of the occult, which it had rejected a priori, in order to know what there may be in it that is true. Religion itself has shown its power of survival and is undergoing an evolution, the final sense of which is still obscure. In this new phase of the mind that we see beginning, however crudely and hesitatingly, there can be detected the possibility of a pressure towards some decisive turn and advance of the spiritual evolution in nature. And I think we'll be getting to his greater point soon when he comes to focus again on India. He did a couple of pages ago, as you know. But it isn't that he's looking at the Western forms of religion and finding this new spirit stirring within it, because at that time, 19th and 20th century religion in the West, we see the ossification of those faiths. Where we see life getting stirred anew is in India, is in the activation of the old yogic ideals stirred and brought in cups to a thirsty humanity by Vivekananda, Sri Ramakrishna, and then, of course, later by Sri Aurobindo and Sri Ramana Maharshi, bringing the living truth of the Sanatana Dharma back to the mass of humanity in India. Religion, he says, rich but with a certain obscurity in her first infrarational stage, has tended under the overweight of the intellect to pass into a clear but bare rational interspace. But it must in the end follow the upward curve of the human mind and rise more fully at its summits towards its true or greatest field in the sphere of a suprarational consciousness and knowledge. So we have to press beyond the rational curve and arrive at the truth consciousness. If we look at the past, we can still see the evidences of this line of natural evolution, although most of its earlier stages are hidden from us in the unwritten pages of prehistory. It has been contended that religion in its beginnings was nothing but a mass of animism, fetishism, magic, totemism, taboo, myth, superstitious symbol, with the medicine man as priest, a mental fungus of primitive human ignorance, later on at its best a form of nature worship. Now, I think rising to many of our minds is, of course, the figure of Max Müller in the late 19th century, you know, translating first into English, though he was German, the great texts of India, the Upanishads, some of the Veda, etc. And they would see the Veda as being nothing but these things, not great records of spiritual experience and exploration, which Sri Aurobindo found them to be. He continues, "It could well have been so in the primitive mind, though we have to add the proviso that behind much of its beliefs and practices, there may have been a truth of an inferior but very effective kind that we have lost with our superior development. Primitive man lives much in a low and small province of his life being. And this corresponds on the occult plane to an invisible nature which is of a like character and whose occult powers can be called into activity by a knowledge and methods to which the lower vital intuitions and instincts may open a door of access. This might be formulated in the first stage of religious belief and practice, which would be occult after a crude inchoate fashion in its character and interests, not yet spiritual. Its main element would be a calling in of small life powers and elemental beings to the aid of small life desires and a rude physical welfare." So he admits that idea of a vitalistic kind of religion where man, no longer simply physical, but now growing aware of his vital nature, is in affinity with the vital powers that govern and inform the universe, and so has a confluence of influence there. Does that make sense? Well, there's an energy exchange between the vital conscious beings and this human who is seeking their intercession in his affairs. That may be. He's got a small world that he lives in, and these beings comfortably inhabit it. That may be true, but that's not all. But there is grounds to say that there is animism, a limited sphere of contact with what is beyond the physical, through this approach. This kind of religion clearly existed in the past. But this primitive stage, he says, if it is indeed such and not in what we still see of it, a fall or a vestige, a relapse from a higher knowledge belonging to a previous cycle of civilization, or the debased remnants of a dead or obsolete culture, can have been only a beginning. So his point here is that while we can find evidence for this in tribal societies in the world, were they like that in their origin, or were they falling away from a greater culture which is past, which we can no longer find evidence for? Are they remnants? Are they detritus, in a sense, from former great civilizations? We can't know that because we simply haven't got the evidentiary basis to make that judgment. It was followed, after whatever stages, by the more advanced type of religion, of which we have a record in the literature or surviving documents of the early civilized peoples. This type, composed of a polytheistic belief and worship, a cosmology, a mythology, a complexus of ceremonies, practices, ritual, and ethical obligations interwoven sometimes deeply into the social system, was ordinarily a national or tribal religion intimately expressive of the stage of evolution of thought and life reached by the community. In the outer structure, we still miss the support of a deeper spiritual significance. But this gap was filled in the greater, more developed cultures by a strong background of occult knowledge and practices, or else by carefully guarded mysteries with a first element of spiritual wisdom and discipline. Occultism occurs more often as an addition or superstructure, but is not always present. The worship of divine powers, sacrifice, a surface piety, and social ethics are the main factors. A spiritual philosophy or idea of the meaning of life seems at first to be absent, but its beginnings are often contained in the myths and mysteries, and in one or two instances fully emerge out of them so that it assumes a strong separate existence. So you can see here some perhaps vague allusions to formations which could become Vedic, which could become the Eleusinian mysteries, either in India or in Greece. The exact parallels are not spelled out. It is possible, indeed, that it is the mystic or the incipient occultist who was everywhere the creator of religion and imposed his secret discoveries in the form of belief, myth, and practice on the mass human mind. For it is always the individual who receives the intuitions of nature and takes the step forward, dragging or drawing the rest of humanity behind him. But even if we give the credit of this new creation to the subconscious mass mind, it is the occultist and mystic element in that mind which created it, and it must have found individuals through whom it could emerge. For a mass experience or discovery or expression is not the first method of nature. It is at some one point or a few points that the fire is lit and spreads from hearth to hearth, from altar to altar. But the spiritual aspiration and experience of the mystics was usually casketed in secret formulas and given only to a few initiates. It was conveyed to the rest, or rather preserved for them, in the mass of religious or traditional symbols. It is these symbols that were the heart's core of religion in the mind of an early humanity. And here he almost nakedly means the Veda. He means the Eleusinian mysteries. He means the Hermetic heritage that came from Egypt into Greek thinking. Hermes, Trismegistus, etc. Because we find there that the outer symbols, which the laity may understand in an exoteric fashion, to have an inner life behind them, which you could only know if you were initiated into those secrecies. Without that key, you lived in the outer. You had no inlook into the secrets. You had to be of a certain character. You had to be of a certain strength. You had to be sincere in your approach. And if you had the necessary qualities, then you gained initiation. So this is that second stage of religion. Out of this second stage, there emerged a third, which tried to liberate the secret spiritual experience and knowledge and put it at the disposal of all as a truth that could have a common appeal and must be made universally available. a tendency prevailed not only to make the spiritual element the very kernel of the religion, but to render it attainable to all the worshipers by an exoteric teaching. As each esoteric school had had its system of knowledge and discipline, so now each religion was to have its system of knowledge, its creed, and its spiritual discipline. Here, in these two forms of the spiritual evolution, the esoteric and the exoteric, the way of the mystic and the way of the religious man, we see a double principle of evolutionary nature. The principle of intensive and concentrated evolution in a small space, and the principle of expansion and extension so that the new creation may be generalized in as large a field as possible. The first is the concentrated, dynamic, and effective movement. The second tends towards diffusion and status. As a result of this new development, the spiritual aspiration, at first carefully treasured by a few, became more generalized in mankind, but it lost in purity, height, and intensity. So this is the third. This is the system of knowledge, which develops a firm creed and a discipline, which begins with this concentrated experience, but then is generalized, broadcast, thrown out. As a result of this new development, the spiritual aspiration at first, the mystics founded their endeavor on a power of suprarational knowledge, intuitive, inspired, revelatory, and on the force of the inner being to enter into occult truth and experience. But these powers are not possessed by men in the mass, or possessed only in a crude, undeveloped, and fragmentary initial form on which nothing could be safely founded. So for them, in this new development, the spiritual truth had to be clothed in intellectual forms of creed and doctrine, in emotional forms of worship, and in a simple but significant ritual. At the same time, the strong spiritual nucleus became mixed, diluted, alloyed. It tended to be invaded and aped by the lower elements of mind and life and physical nature. It was this mixture and alloy and invasion of the spurious, this profanation of the mysteries and the loss of their truth and significance, as well as the misuse of the occult power that comes by communication with invisible forces, that was most dreaded by the early mystics and prevented by secrecy, by strict discipline, by restriction to the few fit initiates. Another untoward result or peril of the diffusive movement and the consequent invasion has been the intellectual formalization of spiritual knowledge into dogma and the materialization of living practice into a dead mass of cult and ceremony and ritual, a mechanization by which the spirit was bound to depart in course of time from the body of the religion. But this risk had to be taken, for the expansive movement was an inherent necessity of the spiritual urge and evolutionary nature. So if we see first an early attempt to contact the secret forces behind nature, and then we establish a means of living in communion with them, and we confine that to a secret group which knows the paths by initiation, by practice, by discipline. Later we find that the evolutionary force will not rest with this early perfection, that instead it has to become organized, presented to the mind, and if through that mentation it becomes more and more externalized, at least those ideas become available to all. And otherwise, we would be left with a tiny minority of humanity introduced to the realm of the spirit. So even if we lose something, then we gain something too. So this is where we leave it tonight. The insight must be broadcast and the mass invited to participate. This is the nature of social evolution within the development of an evolving consciousness on Earth. We can't simply aim at personal transformation. We can't simply keep it to a small closeted group of individuals. It has to be thrown out. It has to be offered widely. We have to move from the personal to social transformation. And it continues. The need continues. But now we have to grow beyond the realm of this belt of the mind, don't we? By first discovering the soul within and then arching above. We're going to put our bookmarks there. And I think the section that we take from Savitri tonight speaks to the limits of religion. So I don't think we've read from this before. This is in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, in Canto 3, the entry into the inner countries. The spirit's almighty freedom was not here. A schoolman mind had captured life's large space, but chose to live in bare and paltry rooms, parked off from the too vast, dangerous universe, fearing to lose its soul in the infinite. Even the idea's ample sweep was cut into a system, chained to fixed pillars of thought, or riveted to matter's solid ground, or else the soul was lost in its own heights. Obeying the ideal's high-browed law, thought based a throne on unsubstantial air, disdaining earth's flat triviality. It barred reality out to live in its dreams, or all stepped into a systemed universe. Life's empire was a managed continent, its thoughts an army ranked and disciplined. Uniformed, they kept the logic of their fixed place at the bidding of the trained centurion mind. Or each stepped into its station like a star, or marched through fixed and constellated heavens, or kept its feudal rank among its peers in the sky's unchanging cosmic hierarchy. Or like a high-bred maiden with chaste eyes, forbidden to walk unveiled in the public ways, she must in close, secluded chambers move, her feeling in cloisters live or gardened paths. Life was consigned to a safe, level path. It dared not tempt the great and difficult heights or climb to be neighbor to a lonely star, or skirt the danger of the precipice, or tempt the foam-curled breaker's perilous laugh, adventure's lyrist, danger's amateur, or into her chamber call some flaming god, or leave the world's bounds and where no limits are, meet with the heart's passion the adorable, or set the world ablaze with the inner fire. A chastened epithet in the prose of life, she must fill with color just her sanctioned space, not break out of the cabin of the idea, nor trespass into rhythms too high or vast. Even when it soared into ideal air, thought's flight lost not itself in heaven's blue. It drew upon the skies a patterned flower of disciplined beauty and harmonic light. A temperate, vigilant spirit governed life. Its acts were tools of the considering thought, too cold to take fire and set the world ablaze, or the careful reasons, diplomatic moves, testing the means to a prefigured end, or at the highest pitch, some calm will's plan, or a strategy of some high command within, to conquer the secret treasures of the gods, or win for a masked king some glorious world, not a reflex of the spontaneous self, an index of the being and its moods, a winging of conscious spirit, a sacrament of life's communion with the still supreme, or its pure movement on the eternal's road. Or else, for the body of some high idea, a house was built with two close-fitting bricks, action and thought cemented, made a wall of small ideals limiting the soul. Even meditation mused on a narrow seat, and worship turned to an exclusive God, to the universal in a chapel prayed, whose doors were shut against the universe, or kneeled to the bodiless impersonal of mind shut to the cry and fire of love. A rational religion dried the heart. It planned a smooth life's act with ethics rule, or offered a cold and flameless sacrifice. The sacred book lay on its sanctified desk, wrapped in interpretation's silken strings. A credo sealed up its spiritual sense. It is not our fate. Our destiny lies far beyond. Let's keep moving. Namaste. Jai Ma.